Om Shri Sai Ram. Dear Radio Sai listeners, greetings and a warm welcome for today's Thursday Live. I am Raghu from Team Radio Sai, and right now we will be hosting the segment Morning Glory. Sister Karuna is away for today, so she asked me to host the segment for today. At the very outset, dear listeners, as always, let us all collectively offer our most humble, prayerful and grateful pranams at the lotus feet of the voice and listener, the heart and soul of Radio Sai Global Harmony, that is Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. And I thank him profusely for giving me this opportunity to host a segment in his radio week after week. Today is 2nd of May 2018 and, beg your pardon, 2019, and it's a pleasant day here in the ashram. In fact, today it's a bit cloudy and cool, a welcoming change for Parthi during this hot summer. And the time right now in our studio is 9:40 a.m. And just now the Vedam and Bhajan session concluded in Cyclone Hall. It concluded with the Mangala Arati. And these Vedam and Bhajan sessions came to you live through Asia Stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. And as I'm speaking to you right now, Swami's devotees have lined up in Cyclone Hall to offer their pranams to Swami. Today is 2nd of May and 6th of May, 6th of this month, that is on Monday, we will be celebrating Ishwaramma Day, a day dedicated to Swami's mother. On this occasion, I would like to recall the three wish that Mother Ishwaramma had and which Swami fulfilled. Three very humble and small wish. The first wish was that during those days, this was the period of 1940s or maybe 1950s. During those days, Puttaparthi was extremely remote village and there was no proper drinking water. There was no proper medical facilities, no school at Parthi. So Mother Ishwaramma had three wishes. The first wish was that there was no proper drinking water facility in Parthi, so all the villagers had to go to Chitravati River to fetch the water for their home. So Mother Ishwaramma told Swami to dig a well in Parthi so that it will be easy for all to get access to water. Now, Swami not only just dug a well in Parthi, but he undertook and completed one of the largest drinking water projects in the world by any private organizations. And we all know about it. The drinking water projects in Anandapur district, the drinking water project in Chennai, which quenched the thirst of millions of people. The second wish that Mother Ishwaramma had was that Puttaparthi should have a hospital. There was no hospital or no medical facility during those days, and if someone gets ill, they had to walk few kilometers to reach the nearby medical facility, which was just a small dispensary during those days, which was built by Britishers because India was being ruled by British in 1940s, right? So Mother Isharama expressed her wish of having a hospital in Puttaparthi, and very soon a general hospital in Puttaparthi was constructed, the Sri Sathyasai General Hospital, and then another general hospital in Whitefield, Bengaluru was constructed by Bhagwan, the Sri Sathyasai General Hospital in Whitefield. And then in 1991 came the super specialty hospital in Puttaparthi, and after 10 years from then, in the year 2001, another super specialty hospital in Whitefield, Bengaluru. All this provides the state-of-the-art medical services free of cost to all without any distinction. So this was the second wish which Mother Ishwarama expressed, that is a hospital in Puttaparthi. The third wish that Mother Ishwarama had was a school in Puttaparthi. There was no proper school in Puttaparthi during those days, and children had to walk few kilometers to get to the nearby school, which was in Bukkapatnam or Kodajuru or somewhere. And Swami started the Sri Sathyasai primary school in Puttaparthi, then the Sri Sathyasai higher secondary school, and the University of Higher Learning, which has now got four campuses, the Prashant Nilayam campus, the Muddenahalli campus, the Whitefield, the Brindavan campus, and the Anandapur campus, which provides free education, which is today considered one of the best in the country. So these were the three humble and selfless wish of Mother Ishwaramma, which has become beneficial for all of us. So in honor of Swami's mother, Mother Ishwarama, we will be celebrating Mother Ishwarama Day on May 6th. Alright, coming back to the segment Morning Glory. Today in the segment Morning Glory, I will be playing for you an interview with Dr. Sunil Menon. And in conversation with him is Radio Sai's Karuna Munshi. And this interview was recorded in Radio Sai studio in the year 2016. So have a listen, please.
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to a special conversation. The topic of discussion today is integrative medicine or holistic health, and my guest is especially qualified to enlighten us on this topic. His name is Dr. Sunil Menon, MD, and Dr. Sunil Menon is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Sathyasai General Hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam. By way of his academic background, I am pleased to inform you that Dr. Menon completed his MD in respiratory medicine from the Mumbai University. He went on to specialize in allergy and environmental medicine with AAEM in the United States under Dr. Bill Ray, a pioneer on the subject. He continued his further training in nutritional medicine with various experts in the field while in the United Kingdom. Presently, he works as the head of the department in Swami's General Hospital right here in Prashanthi Nilayam. And currently, he continues to be associated with doctors in the United States who practice a new field called functional medicine, which takes a holistic approach to disease management. He is very interested in introducing some of his principles to the patients who attend General Hospital. And these principles include yoga. So, keeping Swami's teachings in mind, we thought it was an ideal time for us to bring our listeners up to speed on this very concept of functional medicine, which takes this holistic approach to disease management. On that very happy note, I am glad to welcome Dr. Sunil Menon to Radio Sai. Sairam, sir.
Sairam, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here and share some of my thoughts on the subject and whatever little bit I know. Thank you.
And we are truly honored to have you. We have so much to learn from you. Now, we noticed, Dr. Menon, that there is a need to shift the healthcare paradigm, and this is becoming public discourse, not only in India, but also in the United States, in the United Kingdom, parts of Europe. What can you tell us about it?
Well, science always has needed something new to happen if things don't work. So for a long time, doctors have been realizing Western medicine, as we call it, conventional medicine, as we call it, has been very successful in acute care. And the technology has boomed, and the pharmaceutical companies have their share in it. and health has become an industry to save patients. And it has been quite successful. If you're caught in the right time, you're close to a good hospital, and you have the facilities, including the fact whether you can afford all that. Yeah. Acute care medicine is actually doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trained in conventional medicine, and you know I'm trained in to give acute care. And in the general hospital, you know, most of the patients who do come in an acute state of need or help, we do help them. The problem is, statistics show that chronic disease is increasing. And our healthcare approach is not really, really an answer to chronic disease. What they call as non-communicable diseases is on the increase. For example, diabetes, which was about 15th on the list in India, has now jumped up to number 6 position.
Hmm.
And they say by 2050, it'll be number 2 or number 3.
Oh, alarming.
The other thing they noticed was that 80% of chronic diseases are diet and lifestyle mediated.
Tough one.
And if it is diet and lifestyle, they should be preventable.
Yes.
And all over the world, they are worried.
What percentage did you say? 60?
80%.
80%. So it's not your DNA you can blame.
Nope. No, unfortunately, only 25% of the conditions can be blamed on the DNA. The rest is environment and diet. That's the shocking thing they realize now. You're not born or prone to diabetes. You may have the gene somewhere in your body hanging about, but you become diabetic because of a diet and your lifestyle.
And that's very unfortunate what you said about diabetes in India.
Yeah.
So we are leading such poor lifestyle, making poor lifestyle choices. And
true.
Our diet choices, that we are going up the list.
True.
So what exactly is the difference between acute and chronic illness?
Well, basically, I'll talk about the approach. You know,
yes.
In an acute illness, why modern medicine works is because we are taught to deal with a patient's complaint. We are taught to investigate the patient. We are taught to do some tests. And then we reach a conclusion of what to give. And in most of the conditions that come to us in an acute state, there are protocols to deal with it. Unfortunately, if you use the same methodology in a chronic illness, say for example, a diabetic, there are multifactorial things that's happening in the patient. All diabetics are not the same. Unfortunately, again, Western medicine treats everybody the same. And they got the same protocol. And that doesn't work because individual prescription is now being demanded by the condition of the patient. And we find where did the patient come from, what lifestyle did the patient lead, and what led to the diabetes may have different factors which need to be addressed. For example, in a particular case, it may be just diet. In another case, it may be genes. In a third case, it may be the general lifestyle. And the fourth case, it may be stress. If you know what is really precipitating the diabetes, the same formula doesn't work. So a patient should be assessed in such a way that we take all these factors into account. The problem is today's doctors don't have the time for that. It takes quite a bit of investment by the doctor to do this, and it takes a lot of investment by the patient to participate in his or her health. Modern science and modern technology and the way we are brought up, we want the doctor to fix the problem. Most of my patients who come to my room and sit in front of me, they've got a lot of issues, but they don't want to discuss that. They come with a problem and they say, "Doctor, you fix it for me." They don't even want to participate in the fixing. They feel the injection or the drug or the tablet will do the job. They go back to their diet and lifestyle. Nothing changes. And we find that pharmaceutical companies are inventing new medicines every year. But the progress of disease all over the world has continued.
That seems so incoherent.
True. There is a subject which come up in the functional medicine group. They call it the 21st century medicine. And they say that their approach is so radically different. they say if a chair has got four legs, one leg is the diet, the second leg is the lifestyle, the third leg is the nutrients and whether they exercise or not. And surprisingly, the fourth leg is yoga, meditation and spirituality.
Really?
And that is what pulled me into this group of people who seem to reflect what Swami was saying.
Exactly. Swami is the pioneer of this stream of medicine and all medicines, of course.
True. And maybe it's the right time for human beings to wake up and realize the Annamaya Kosha is what the doctors are dealing with till now.
Which is the outermost sheath of the human personality.
And we have forgotten about the Manomaya Kosha and the Pranamaya Kosha totally. These people are now realized that you cannot just treat the Annamaya Kosha with drugs. You need to bring the other koshas into the picture.
So what can you tell us, or how can you educate us to understand the need to treat ourselves as a conglomerate of all these koshas or the various layers or sheets that make the human personality?
Well, to start with the first kosha, the Annamaya Kosha, it's made of Anna, food. That's where the diet comes in.
Okay.
And invariably the exercise is part of it. And diet just doesn't consist of food. When we talk about diet, we are talking about nutrients. And we must ask ourselves a question that what has changed? Everybody eats food. Why should some people fall sick and not get the nutrients? For that, historically speaking, we must look at what was the human being's diet thousands of years ago. They lived very close to nature. And there is a strong connection between what you eat, and what you breathe, and where you live, to how your genes and how your body performs. For example, Eskimos, they eat a lot of blubber and fish oil and fish. They hardly eat vegetables and grains. If you look at the Eskimo diet, you know, it can't be followed by any other culture. But their genes have adjusted to the environment. They hand over that to their children. If you take the same Eskimo and modernize him and give him an American diet, within 10 years, they all get diabetes and hypertension.
But they don't have diabetes up in the North Pole.
No. They don't even have heart attacks.
So the body has just adapted.
Adapted. And what has happened today is that we have forgotten that our genes play a part. We inherit our lifestyle and diet habits, which is why perhaps, historically speaking, we had caste systems, because each caste had its own environment, own lifestyle and own diet habits.
And vocation.
And vocation. Mm. And all of them matched with what they did and what
yes.
they ate. They had a separate set of vibrations. Today what has happened is two things have happened. One is that we don't live our lives close to nature. For example, our hormones are related to sunlight. So when you wake up, your hormones kick start, and then throughout the day it plays its part. By 7 o'clock it starts shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
If you live in artificial light, this doesn't happen. And the sleep hormone called melatonin mm-hmm. requires darkness.
Yes.
But if you watch TV or if you're sitting in front of a computer, you are messing with the melatonin. Your body gets confused. You say the light is still coming in, so mm-hmm. I should be awake. So what it does is it produces cortisol to keep you awake. And cortisol, unfortunately, suppresses further melatonin. So your whole hormonal cycle is disturbed. You don't get good sleep. When you wake up next morning, to kickstart, you take a coffee with a lot of sugar.
Yes.
And invariably that gives you initial energy, but it is messing with the natural cycle. It can go on when you're young, but after the age of 45, this starts breaking down.
But even amongst youngsters in yeah. the IT industry who work on American time zones in India in call centers, this is a huge problem because they are exposed to artificial light all night and they have a very disrupted sleep cycle.
True. So now the research is showing that some people adapt. The person who comes to the doctor is the one who's not adapted. So we are generally dealing with people who are not adapted.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are increasing. That is the danger. You see, if the numbers remained at, say, what 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, we wouldn't worry so much.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers are increasing so much that now we are realizing the human body is adapted since millions of years. For a gene to change, it takes 1 million years.
Wow, so many generations.
Exactly. So maybe in the next million years, you know, we may have human beings who are different than us. At the present moment, we are not winning the battle at all. And the costs are going up. It's not affordable for a person to really, really look after health. Health has become expensive. It has become an industry.
Hmm.
When actually it shouldn't. You know, it should be preventive. And it should be lifestyle choices and diet. So what these functional medicine, integrative medicine and holistic medicine people have found out, that if you actually take that individual and give them advice to change their lifestyle, to change their diet and become as organic as possible. And the problem now is the processing of foods. The micronutrients are not available. And the soil has been so enriched with fertilizers and artificial means and pesticides that the chemistry has changed. So what you see as food on the table is not the real great-grandmother's food on the table. And the wheat and the grains have also been modified. GMO foods have come.
Hmm.
And they found that the nutritional value really doesn't exist. So cleverly what the companies do is they add some rubbish and say that this is fortified.
Hmm.
But it's not natural.
I see.
And the human body is so clever that it can make the difference. That, oh, this is not coming. For example, if you take magnesium, as an example, as a mineral that's missing in 80% of our diet now, we fortify with magnesium oxide, which is the cheapest compound available.
In a multivitamin tablet.
Multivitamin tablet.
Yes.
That's the worst chemical that the body can take because magnesium oxide is not absorbed.
I see.
The body doesn't like it, in other words. It's not biological. So what the body does is throw it out.
Uh-huh.
So we giving supplements in this chemical fashion has not really matched our lifestyle.
What is a natural source of magnesium?
Well, the fact is they don't have a natural source from fruits and vegetables. But if you want some, really want to get lots of it, then you have to eat nuts and seeds. Out of which the cheapest available in Parthi is pumpkin seeds, which are melon seeds, which they throw away. All they have to do is just, you know, dry it, roast it and eat it.
Peanuts also?
Peanuts, yes, certain amount. But if you want the kind of high quality magnesium which our body needs as a replacement, it's found in green leafy vegetables a lot. But then you have to eat at least 4 servings of it, which many people don't. The vegetables are just floating about. So the quantity matters, which is the problem. Really, the you know whole family sharing you know a dish, the amount of vegetable going to as a serving to a person is very much reduced. And the other big issue now is with oil. Oil has come up as one of the biggest issues that
and
we are
bombarded.
Refining.
We are bombarded with advertisements that confuse us which is the right oil. What is your take on it, doctor?
Well, the research now shows that fat has been mentioned to be one of the biggest toxins. And we said that saturated fat should never be eaten. And we should all go into polyunsaturated fat and all that rubbish till now. And we believed it. And the real culprit is sugar. So sugar is the one that is the killer today. Sugar in the sense that doesn't include sugar by itself. It includes all our refined flour
and
polished rice. That breaks down to sugar. It's equivalent to sugar.
I see.
So our body doesn't differentiate. So if you eat polished rice, a cupful of polished rice is equivalent to, you know, 6 spoons of sugar.
Oh, dear.
So, in the past, that wasn't the case. We used food that wasn't refined at all. And the oil we used was cold-pressed. And it was either cold-pressed or extracted, you know, by just squeezing it between, you know, a grinder in the local village.
Yes.
And it was brought home and you cook with it and you don't use it for, you know, a month or 2 months. We take the amount we need and then we crush it again. And that is biologically alive. And it's got all the ingredients. The other problem is refined oil is omega-6. It's a highly inflammatory oil. And omega-6 is not very good. It's good for the body for certain jobs. What we need is omega-3. Omega-3 is unfortunately not very well absorbed unless in vegetarian diets. It's mainly found in fish oil.
Fish oil, yeah.
And we have to eat a lot of flaxseed to get a lot of omega-3.
Yes.
When you refine oil, all the omega-3s disappeared.
Oh.
Yeah. And mustard oil is another choice, which has got quite a bit of omega-3. Coconut oil has got some.
What about ghee? Because Ayurveda says organic ghee is very good.
Exactly. So now they are saying that provided the cow is eating grass,
yes,
and it's your own cow, and you're lovingly, you know, looking after it.
Hmm.
If you mix milk from 20 cows and then produce ghee out of it, that's a problem. So the source is the issue now, and it's become a problem all over the world. When you say organic, how organic is it? Can we go back to that level of manufacturing? No easy answer. But if you won't clear your health issues, you have no choice. You have to really, really get out of the system, allow the body to repair itself, then maybe you'll tolerate a little bit of, you know, the processed food. And that's the kind of patients that come to us, where the damage is so severe that they feel a drug can rectify it. Unfortunately, in chronic illness, it doesn't do the job.
When you say processed food, what exactly do you mean? I can't think of too many things that I buy off the shelf which has not gone through some process.
Yeah. The ideal thing would be, you know, the apple should come straight from a tree without pesticides on it. If the banana is being artificially ripened while it is being transported from Africa or wherever, the process is interfered with. It's the processing. If you pasteurize milk and then you mix milk and put it in a plastic container and sell it after 2 weeks, that is processed food. But if you actually take milk from a cow next to you, or in the olden days, the cow used to be brought and the milking was done in front of you. So it is straight from there to the boiling and you drink it, and that's the end of the story. So processing is now part of our lifestyle. But by heavy processing, I mean chemicals. For example, refined oil comes to you without odor, golden colored, you know, looking so nice, with a high boiling point, is processed through a lot of chemical processes, which destroys the original organic oil.
And, you know, it took me so many years to realize that there is no grain called canola. When I was buying canola oil, it is CAN, comes from Canada, and Ola is oil, and it's just a genetically modified grain.
True. The tragedy is they don't sort of tell us about all these things. If you look at the fact that where is sugar present? It's present everywhere, whether you use a ketchup or a sauce or buy bread.
Yes.
So sugar is one of the hidden culprits. And now the research shows that sugar is the one that causes what is known as insulin resistance. And we have replaced carbohydrate in our diet. So if you compare a diet 10,000 years ago, the amount of grains they used wasn't that much. And then when it became very cheap and available to everybody, and it became a good source of, you know, calories, people started replacing normal food with a lot of grain. And originally, grain was there as an extra bit on the plate. But today, it's a lot of grain and a little bit of chutney and
everything else around it.
Around it.
They're fixins.
And we have become a carbohydrate-based population.
True.
And our human body has got 20 feet of intestine to digest meals. And why is there such a long intestine there? It shows that it's expected food to be really broken down gradually. And we are supposed to eat what is known as complex carbohydrates, carbohydrates in its original form. Today, because of modification, the grain has got less of the fiber and more of the carbs, which is good because you get you know, more energy out of it. Unfortunately, in a sugar format.
Now, many of our listeners, for example, are either vegetarian or are leaning towards vegetarianism. And there is always this confusion regarding the protein requirement for a healthy body. What is your advice to vegetarians when it comes to seeking out good sources of protein? And how much?
I think that's an excellent question because we don't have an easy answer to that. Poverty and malnutrition go together. If you're undernourished, you know, it goes together. So the replacement of good protein from varied sources is the answer. So if you eat a lot of different lentils and mix it with a lot of legumes and then eat a lot of nuts and seeds, then a vegetarian is fine. But if you look at the expense of feeding a whole family like that, is the problem. There is no really, really easy answer to compensate for the fact that a vegetarian needs a varied format of protein intake, because the essential amino acids are not present in every grain or seed or lentil or legume.
Ragi is supposed to be.
So one thing is the unfortunate thing in vegetarian food, one particular source cannot cover for all the sources. So you need what is known as a balanced mix of different protein sources. So if you take urad dal along with moong dal, along with groundnuts and other legumes like broad beans or narrow beans, then there is a mix along with ragi. That's good.
And along with seeds and nuts.
And along with seeds and nuts. And in the past, eating seeds and nuts was rather standard in every family. All grandmothers had a little tin of various seeds and nuts, including my grandfather. She used to have different formats. I find even jackfruit seeds were roasted and eaten in Kerala. And it's not just the jackfruit itself is eaten. Almonds were eaten, cashew nuts were eaten. It was all available, and it was part of our culture to eat different seeds. Unfortunately, what has happened is we have become partly westernized. And then we have gone into what is known as convenience foods. So, and these convenience foods are not really nutrient dense, as you call it. You know?
They're just calorie dense.
It's calorie dense. But that's become, you know, a habit of people to, you know, have a chai and then go for the wrong food. Yeah. Nobody eats chai and peanuts or chai and seeds or chai and, you know, nuts.
Yeah, you want samosa or a bhaji or something fried.
Exactly.
Deep fried. Twice, if preferably.
So invariably the nutrient content is zero and the calorie is very high. And nutrition is a very poorly taught subject in schools. And most of the parents who come to me, they have little idea of, you know, you're feeding the wrong things to a growing child. They also believe that milk compensates for a lot of nutrition.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, you know, human beings are the only animals on the planet drinking some other animal's milk. We have adapted. But unfortunately, about 60% of human beings are milk intolerant. Only the people in France, Scandinavia, and certain few countries have milk tolerant. India in some parts. But generally, we are milk intolerant.
Is it a genetic issue?
It is, most probably.
I think people are not that conscious about lactose intolerance in India.
True. We don't diagnose it because the symptoms are different in different individuals. And the other thing is the type of milk has changed. The original milk, it's called A2 milk, comes from the original cow which ate grass.
Mm.
All over the world now we got the hybrid milk. We got the hybrid cows. It's called A1 milk. And they found A1 milk is highly allergic and very intolerant. And many patients, when they switch to, you know, a desi cow, as they call it, they tolerate the milk. They digest it better.
Wow.
So there are a lot of factors that is involved.
It's like Devonshire cream, which is supposed to be the best, but those cows eat specific kind of grass only.
Exactly.
It reflects in the taste of the milk and this purity.
The fact is omega-3 is available from the grass. Modern cows, the way they make milk is they feed them grain.
Yes.
And
sometimes even
and
worse
cows don't
things.
Eat grain. Cows
yeah,
don't eat
it's
grass.
Not their natural food.
Natural food. And invariably, you know, they fatten them up quite a bit. That's mainly for the meat industry. But the milk is spoiled. So milk, and they get a lot of antibiotics and,
yes,
they,
and
they,
hormones.
They get a lot of hormones. And invariably, they are messing with, that's what I call processing. Processing doesn't just end in a box. Processing starts with the animal itself.
Hmm.
And it's a subject which people are aware of. And they are going organic, but the industry is in charge. So invariably they rule the roost. They control what people eat.
And they inundate us with messages through advertising and completely brainwash us.
True. The tragedy, the other problem really is that people tend to believe what somebody else says. And when they come to a nutritional approach, they're quite surprised that nobody talks in that language. So invariably they are suspicious that, oh, nobody told us about this till now. Why are you bringing this subject all of a sudden? But common sense actually works. I'll tell you a simple story I read the other day. I think it was came in the Deccan Chronicle. And I was surprised to read that article. There is this tribe somewhere in Assam living very close to the forest. They were leading a very traditional life. Nothing processed. Everything they made was made right there. Most of the forest produce actually fed them. Unfortunate thing was they were not modern. They were not educated. So the government went and said, you don't have much cash with you. You know, you're living like tribals. You're not coming into the modern world. So they wanted to modernize them. So in order to help them, they said, let's grow some crops or cash crops, as they call it. And they built, they deforested the place, and they forested it with cash-growing crops like eucalyptus and, you know, teak and all sorts of things. to end the story, basically the forest died. So these guys didn't have anything to eat. So the government said, don't worry, we'll supply you with sugar and
rice and more sugar.
More sugar, yes. and flour and rice at cheap rates and our refined oil. And the elders didn't like it very much, but they had no choice. After 10 years, they noticed that their children were falling ill. And then a dietary team went to check, I think a medical team went to check the standard of health of these people and found it had gone down. There was malnourishment, there was undernourishment, there was all sorts of health problems which was never existed.
So much for the civilized approach to living.
In 10 years.
Yes.
Now these people then protested. Actually the ladies, the elderly ladies, they said, we want all of us to go back to our original diet, give back our forest. So they abandoned that site and went to a separate forest area and let the original site grow back. And when they shifted their area of living and their diet and lifestyle, everything improved by itself.
My God, amazing.
And this is...
And within a span of what, 2 decades?
2 decades.
My God.
And that whole article came up and written by a nutritionist. And I was surprised to read it in Deccan Chronicle, which shows that it's not that we don't know the subject. We know that if human beings shift to what we call as modern diet, and if it doesn't have the nutrients in it, the body will react. You put the body back into its original habitat, in its original environment, and the original diet. Nature takes care of itself. God has made the body so beautifully. It's got a self-healing process. You have to be intelligent enough to help that self-healing process. And you go into either cure or reversal or remission without drugs.
Now this you were talking about the different koshas or the layers or sheets that make up a person. This is at a physical level. What comes next?
Well, now the latest research shows what is really killing a large percentage of modern individuals is stress. And we think stress as something bionic or something very serious or something which comes with a jolt from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all. The state of happiness of your mind, the way you live life, the way your achievements and, you know, your attitudes are, is contributing to stress. So what is happening today is a lot of unrealistic expectations. And when these unrealistic expectations hit you very slowly, we think that there is no stress. The person pretends to jog through life with a smiling face. They also sort of tend to feel they are actually winning the whole equation. But the body is very clever. However you put that smiley face for society's sake, internally, the mind knows. And what it produces is a hormone called cortisol. Now, cortisol has been created by nature for acute stress. And that is the fight or flight phenomenon.
Hmm.
So when there's an acute problem, you know, 10,000 years ago, problems were either acute, which they had to deal with, and you dealt with it.
Like a tiger attacking me in a forest.
So even if there is a crisis, you know, usually you find that the crisis is solved with a philosophical look at it. It is not that it should be solved. They look at it in a philosophical manner. Today, you know, it's an instant gratification society. They want it to be done. If the bus is a little late, they get angry. So, you know, if you're stuck in a traffic jam, you lose your mind. So we are in a society where stress reaction seems to be normal.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't even bother if that reaction is seen.
Unacceptable. To throw a fit, to use foul language, or to fling your arms and get upset.
And invariably that raises your cortisol.
I see.
And that is a very bad hormone to increase.
And I'm sure it's a slew of other chain reactions that happen. Your blood pressure goes up, you're hyperventilating.
Your blood sugar goes up. And the biggest unfortunate thing is we've got two brains. One is the primitive brain, the reptilian brain, which is required for our emotional reaction and all our emotions. And then we got the cortex, the frontal cortex, which is the brain where the logic and the analysis comes in. Most of the time our reptilian brain is switched on and our reaction is at that level. If we have not practiced, what we need is allow our superior brain to take over. And how to switch is the question. because we are in stress morning till evening, and we are decision making, and we need quick decisions. So what happens is the instant reaction comes in. So we don't reflect, because we don't have time to reflect, is one of the things they say all the time. And cortisol, you know, kickstarts the reptilian brain, and invariably, you know, once it does that, you lose control. And whatever we say, whatever comes out of our mouth, is controlled by the reptilian brain. It's a reactive brain.
And then we can regret over it for the rest of our lives, but the words have escaped.
And how do we train the superior brain, the superior cortex? Well, by meditation. So what they found is that if you want your manomaya kosha to really, really work, there is a machine that can measure what is known as, it's called a heart rate variable measurement. And the machine can measure that. If your heart rate variable has got a very smooth pattern, because the heart rate keeps varying, and the machine, it's not beat to beat, it's not the same. So this machine can monitor it. If it comes in a very smooth fashion, that means invariably your cortisol level is normal, and you're generally calm, and you know, you're okay. If it is all over the place, it means, although you may not be showing it externally, but your heart knows, it shows. So you meditate. And they found that, and this is done in the UK, and if you meditate, your heart rate changes. Immediately it calms down.
So what do you mean by meditate? Is it silent sitting, guided meditation, vipassana?
It is basically something that suits you. And, you know, there are techniques where you just sit in your office and control your breathing. And just watch your breath. And you do it at intervals of, you know, 5 to 10 and stop it. And then after an hour or so, do another 5 to 10. That's good enough to correct your heart rate.
It's like a reset button.
So it's a reset button. So just stop everything and close your eyes and just watch your breath. Now that is the quickest way I've read about with effects, and which anybody can do. But if you talk about, you know, the prolonged format of meditation, which certainly has got more spiritual connotations to it, and a large percentage of people perhaps wouldn't want to go into that area when they're leading a normal life. If they want to do that, that's fine. If they got time to do it, that's fine.
But in the 9-point code of conduct, Swami said we should do Jyoti meditation every day.
Absolutely. So,
if we follow it, we won't have much of this issue of overreacting and falling into the stress trap.
Absolutely. You see, it's health hygiene.
Well said.
So we have to look at the mind hygiene also.
Yes.
So whether you watch television and you have to be in a conference, or whether you have to be in a meeting, you're absorbing all negative energy anyway. Without you knowing, your hormones are going all over the place. How do we switch it off? And you have to have a health hygiene of doing that, and the manomaya kosha is taken care of.
So going further or deeper into this, past the manomaya kosha, what can you teach us?
Well, what they have found in research is, it is not just enough looking after your physical and looking after your mental. You must have a spiritual background. Now, they use the word spiritual, unlike using the word religious.
Religion, yeah.
Because that causes a lot of conflict in your mind.
I wonder why, though. What's the big deal? But yeah, in an age of political correctness, they prefer to use the spiritual.
And then what they found was, what is the biggest problem today that is affecting the Western world, which is perhaps coming here? Isolation and loneliness. So they didn't know what that was all about. They're giving all the physical comforts. They're giving an old people's home all the coins required by an old person. They're putting the old person in front of a television. Didn't work. And the states of dementia and Alzheimer's, most of these patients got worse in such a situation. So nutritionally they were all right. And as far as comforts were there, they were all right. Medically they were looked after by doctors. Loneliness and isolation causes lack of love. And what they discovered was, by just hugging these people, by just putting them into what is known as hugging groups, where strangers went them and sat with them, just held their hands for 10 minutes, need not be their relatives at all, somebody else. It was done silently. It was not done by talk, because talk wasn't required. Just the transference of love perked these people up. So they found that if you're not really spiritual, in the kind of, you know, inverted commas kind of bracket, what was the essence of life was love. And they said, you don't have to be religious, you don't have to be spiritual, but love we can always give. And this was very surprising for them, because in the Western culture, they didn't know the effect of it. Now, in the Indian context, the joint family always had this bonding. There was always a spinster aunt or a widowed aunt or a grandmother who we used to run to. And I know my younger days where there was always this particular person who had a lot of time for us. So if all the other elders are busy, or they will send us to this person, they say, oh, you go to this person. And that person will be calmly sitting down, smiling away, and be with us. What was being transferred was nothing intellectual. No advice. It was just the transfer of, I'm there for you. And that factor is what we basically call spirituality. We are now put a lot of other definitions to it. But the easiest definition, which I think matches with Swami's words all along, start the day with love, spend the day with love, and end the day with love. What is that all about?
And embodiments of love.
Exactly. And he tells doctors too, he said that don't spend, you know, time writing prescriptions. Spend time talking to the patient. He said, I would prefer you talk 20 minutes to the patient and write the prescription in a minute or so, instead of the other way around. So basically, this is the fourth leg of the stool, which I talked about, or the chair. You know, you do the nutrition, you do the diet, you do the lifestyle, you do the exercise, yoga, you do the meditation. If you miss the love factor, it doesn't work. And this is a surprising thing integrative medicine found, because they never thought holistically the love factor was so important, that if you are positive, and the love can come in many forms. And we have found that among patients. Patients who are very innocent and positive, they recover faster. We find our village patient who comes from, you know, the distant villages from Parthi. They come to our hospital. They have absolute faith in Swami. They have absolute faith in the doctor. They have absolute faith in everything.
Thank God. They're not cynical.
Nope.
As the city educated, who have read up on Wikipedia and come.
Exactly. And sometimes we don't know how they recover, you know, and
I think the buy-in is complete.
Exactly. And invariably, it's not our effort. We just don't know that why this patient is waking up and then eating idlis next morning. Who is curing? And if you say that the doctor is curing, I think that is very, very small way of looking at it. In the big picture, what is curing is this patient is full of positivity. And the patient's faith is 100%. There's no doubt in the patient's mind, which we can't transfer with words, we can't transfer with an injection, we can't transfer with a tablet. It is an attitudinal thing, and which should start right from the gate, you see. The moment they enter, the transference of love should start right from the gate. It should transfer to the nurse, it should transfer to the doctor, and to the treatment. And integrative medicine has jumped onto it and realized that if you have all the factors and no love, which is what is happening in modern corporate hospitals, where you get an air-conditioned room, where the consultant comes in, talks to you for a couple of seconds, you get a big bill at the end of the day, and they feel you should be cured.
And you're right, absolutely. I can completely relate to what you're saying. Now, integrative medicine seems like the answer to the problems of healthcare of our times. How is it being received, this outlook, this vision being received by conventional medical schools? Because I noticed some in the US, like Duke and a few others, they were spending quite a bit of their budget and their time on integrative medicine, whereas others are not up to speed.
The sad thing is, it is a health industry.
Yes. Everything is an industry at the end of the day.
And it's controlled by the pharmaceutical companies.
Who want their pills to sell.
And invariably, it's like processed food. Coca-Cola wants everybody to drink Coca-Cola. And you know that, you know, it's such a strong acid that you can wash your toilet bowl with it. So invariably, they found that for any scientific change to occur, attitudinal change to occur, it takes a lot of time. Human beings don't switch very quickly. And in the medical field, it takes more time than necessary. The famous story is the Samwell story of Germany, where he was a gynecologist, obstetrician, in the early 1910. And in those days, the doctors never washed their hands. They used to go from patient to patient, delivering baby to baby, without washing their hands. And they used to just wipe it on their apron. And it was a big privilege for them not to wash hands. And they found the mothers were getting infected with something known as puerperal fever. And he introduced a simple thing. And he said, in those days they didn't have these kind of antiseptics. So he used a very, very strong liquid of bleach. And he told all his doctors, his junior doctors and himself, he said, we'll all wash our hands before going to the next patient. And the infection rate fell. It was practically as high as 40 per 100. It fell to 2 per 100. But it took 75 years for that idea to catch on.
To become protocol.
Yeah, protocol. So, people still didn't wash.
But with IT revolution, you know, grandmothers using WhatsApp, hasn't the pace of adapting quickened, in your opinion?
Adapting in the sense that we have superficially picked up more tools. Mm-hmm. To decrease, the labor of work. Mm-hmm. But in the process, we have lost a lot of our brain tissue because the brain cannot continue its sharpness unless you use it. They found that if after the age of 65, you take up a new profession and a new study, you don't get Alzheimer's.
That's right. I've been reading that. Do you concur with that?
Oh, absolutely. It's because whatever we talk about aging, is because of a misuse and disuse of things. And invariably, all these tools is not adapting. We are learning shortcuts to make our body not work. And nature doesn't work that way because our human biology took a million years to develop. Within a span of 100 years, we are technologically, gone into space and gone all these magic things. In the process, we have ignored the fact that our human being itself is not meant to live like this. We are not meant to live with 24-hour light and 24-hour telephones
and stimulations
and computers and TV. Mm-hmm. We may adapt in another million years, who knows. Mm-hmm. But the present generation is breaking apart and the idea of living life like that is an artificial idea the Western world has brought in. They seem to presume that nature is not important. They have isolated man from nature entirely. Mm-hmm. They also found that, night shift workers get more cancers. Mm. So now night shift jobs, if you take, your insurance doesn't cover you much in the West if you're a night worker because they know you may get cancer. Mm. So now things are working against us. So we should draw a line. How far can we play with nature? Mm. I'm not saying that technology should stop or we shouldn't use, but we must draw a line somewhere.
Dr. Menon, I read somewhere that consumption of pure cold-pressed coconut oil is helpful for preventing dementia and even reversing some amount of Alzheimer's. Is there any scientific basis for that?
Yeah, there is a lot of research, not on all of them, because each person's Alzheimer's is different. Why they came to that conclusion is because it has got a kind of fatty acid. That the brain can use.
I see.
And brain, what they call is type 3 diabetes. You see, the brains in these people, they develop a diabetes called type 3, where the sugar cannot be used. So they call it a type 3 diabetes. Basically, the brains don't function on sugar. Mm-hmm. And invariably, they got high sugar levels, they got insulin resistance. And the shortcut to that was if the brain cell has to get energy, it uses this type of fatty acid.
May I ask a few personal questions? What kind of oil do you use, Dr. Menon, at home?
Well, after coming here, obviously abroad it was easy for me, but after coming here, the oil we use ghee as far as possible.
I see.
And the second thing is coconut oil is what we use. So olive oil is expensive, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And people can't afford it. I would say that if you've got cold pressed oil, even if it's mustard oil, and if you genetically, if you belong to West Bengal, they use mustard oil for ages. Mm-hmm. And mustard oil has got high levels of omega-3.
In Kashmir also, the traditional oil is mustard oil because that's what grows there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So basically, coconut oil they researched on because the American pediatrician who treated her husband who had Alzheimer's tried this oil. Mm. She did her own research on, you know, medium chain triglycerides and found it's useful for the brain. They found which oil has a lot of it. She found coconut oil has a lot of it. And she's the first one who introduced the subject, and then it went into research.
Yes.
And that's how it came up. So coconut oil came accidentally as being a good oil. It has been used in Kerala for centuries. But,
yes.
But unfortunately, if you refine it, that's the end of it. So
cold pressed.
It has to be cold pressed.
I see. And do you use a microwave?
I have one. Emergency, yes.
Okay.
But regularly, no. Mm-hmm. Not recommended.
I see.
Really.
And what are your sources of protein in your diet?
Well, that is one of the major issues that are coming up. And the only way we can compensate is introducing soya. Provided all forms of soya are not good. And ladies shouldn't eat a lot of soya.
Yes. What is the threshold?
That is the problem. It differs from person to person. So you see, nutritional science has got a big handicap now that we can't measure. At least in India, we can't. Abroad, what they do is they feed you with a certain format of diet. Then they measure what are the levels of your cholesterol, what are the levels of your HDL, LDL, where is your sugar going, what are your hormones are doing. And they say, oh, okay, how are you feeling? And they say, this diet suits you. Certain people, they can't eat and switch to certain diets. Unfortunately here, you know, we don't have that science.
Mm-hmm.
We have to sort of go traditionally by asking, what do you generally eat in traditionally in your house? Like Brahmins who are vegetarians, where did they get the protein from?
Mm.
Mainly it was dairy, and mainly it was from, you know, grains and pulses and seeds and nuts. So we had to go that route. Remember, protein is present in everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's present even in vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a wrong idea that protein is found only in meat and whatnot.
Yeah.
That is a wrong
and
concept.
And tofu has protein.
Tofu is very good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, the benefits of integrative medicine in today's age and day, especially in the West where big universities are investing money in it, is it to some extent measurable?
Oh, yes. What they've done is integrative medicine in the past belonged to a series of isolated doctors.
Right.
And most of them didn't have evidence-based, scientific analysis done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this group of people are now getting referred to by the Western medicine and conventional doctors because they're failing in their treatment. And the success rates are now being reported, published. There's a series called Betrayal Series, and I would like all my listeners to go to this series called Betrayal Series.
Okay.
It's a set of videos, free online, and I don't know how long it'll be available, but if they go to that series, they will get the latest info.
Is it on YouTube or?
It's if you just go into betrayalseries.com,
okay.
They'll give you a link.
B-E-T-R-A-Y-A-L.
Betrayal Series. It's a betrayal because, and I would like to add here that the gut has been ignored by conventional medicine. And the gut has got bacteria living in it. And God has given us some extremely good bacteria that should be living there.
Mm-hmm.
This science is a very, very baby science now. Now the reports are coming in that if your gut is not happy, if the bacteria in there are not happy, and if the bad ones come there, it affects the whole system. So they call it the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And a large percentage of patients have got very unhealthy microbiome. This has been discovered. And if you correct the microbiome by your diet, lifestyle, and giving, you know, probiotics and other things, your symptoms disappear.
I see. Yogurt has natural probiotics.
Yes. Yogurt has got one type of the bacilli required.
What are the other sources of good probiotics?
Well, if you actually eat fermented foods, you know, in traditionally...
Like miso and all?
In Indian tradition, pickles and fermental foods and fermentation of foods and pickling was a common thing.
Yeah.
You know, we used to pickle everything. And all these things have different forms of gut bacteria.
I'm so happy to meet a doctor who endorses pickles. Thank you, Dr. Menon.
Yes.
We've been told to stay away from, you know, spicy food, hot food. Yes. Good
well,
to know.
The spiciness is another issue. Basically, I'm talking about pickling in a format it doesn't cause gastritis.
Hmm.
But today, you know, we find more of the spiciness and things have come in. But if you really look at fermented foods, they're fermented for a long time. Most of the pickles that you use, they have been fermenting in the oil juice of
yes.
the thing. And the chili bit nowadays has gone up quite a bit. So
in Japanese food, miso and kombucha.
Miso and kombucha.
Kombucha, both are fermented.
Yeah, so in every culture had. Every culture had. If you look at every culture, they found it by trial and error.
Yeah.
You see, most of the human beings have been living on this planet. and traditionally grandmothers were handing out recipes. They were sort of helping health. And traditionally the tribals and the ancients knew that if we eat like this, everybody's happy and healthy. We are going the other way around. And today, you know, the manufacturing process. See, a manufactured jam is different from the jam my grandmother used to make. She had a peculiar way of making the jam. And while making it, a large percentage of bacteria and things used to get involved in it, which we thought was unhygienic. Today we realize that walking barefoot is a good thing to do. So our hygiene hypothesis has now failed. If you're too hygienic, then your immune system cannot recognize the good and bad. And we need the germs. God has made them. They are not in nature as our enemies. 80% to 90% of them are very healthy germs. It's only 10% that are naughty. And we need the 80 of them. But what we are doing is we are destroying all of them. And our way of looking at the human body is very odd. We feel that if you, you know, destroy the germs who are protecting us, you're very hygienic and clean. No.
You should see young mothers are constantly wiping the floors and their children's hands and actually rendering their children very poor in their immunity.
Swami himself said that walk barefoot.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says things which has got very deep meanings.
And he himself walked barefooted.
Exactly. And he says that how will you get the immunity? You know? So even cesarean sections are causing problems. They would prefer that the baby is born normally because while the baby is born, the baby gets all the bacteria, the flora, which is going to actually go into the gut and produce the first set of the bacteria in the gut. And breastfeeding also does that. And invariably, cesarean sections, they found, is causing babies to become extremely allergic and prone to ill health. So the trick they're doing now is they wipe the baby's face with a swab that is taking the mother's secretions. So science is going round and round saying if nature knows best, you leave everything as natural as possible. You don't have to really, you know, jump over the wall. If you really lead a life where nature intended and or know how to switch off and know how to, you know, allow nature to do this kind of healing once in a while, you know, you can do a cyclic system of I'll fast on, you know, 2 days a week or 1 day a week. On certain days I will eat only these kind of foods. So if you give body a chance to recover and you are mentally happy and, you know, you're very positive, you don't need to, you know, see a doctor at all. And you must get the love and support too. So it's not just, you know, quick fix. Our whole social fundamental attitude of why we are here on earth and what we doing here, what is the purpose of our life comes into the picture. Unfortunately, you know, we are all target oriented and we all got deadlines. And we feel that a person reaches 20, a deadline should be hit. Person reaches 30, another deadline should be hit. We are living very artificial lives. Does it affect health? Well, it's obvious it is. $4.3 trillion is the budget of the economy in the United States, projected for 2023. $4.3 trillion is quite a huge amount without the success being there. So building more super hospitals and more having more cardiac surgeons doing more interventional cardiac surgery is not the answer, because how many can afford that? What about the rest of the population? They will be ignored. So we need a preventive approach, not for the rich, not for the poor, for humanity itself, to realize that, you know, let's work with nature instead of isolating ourselves from it.
Well, Dr. Menon, this has been quite an eye-opening session just listening to you and learning from you. But I still have a whole lot of questions to ask of you, including all these things that we hear about cleansing, emotional cleansing, spiritual detox, physical detox. I want to know about how much exercise and what sort of exercise we need on a regular basis. We hear all kinds of different formulae, 30 minutes, 5 times a week minimum. And does it have to be something related to aerobics or weights? How important is all that? And there are many other topics that we need enlightenment on. But I guess for today, we'll pause right here. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you very, very much for sharing your insights and your wisdom with us.
Thank you, Sai Ram. It was a pleasure.
Sai Ram, sir.
अमर असीम अखंड गम्यम सत्यम शिवम सुंदरम अमर असीम अखंड गम्यम सत्यम शिवम सुंदरम चिदानंद रूपम सदानंद रूपम शिवोहम 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 शिवोहम
Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to our second conversation with Dr. Sunil Menon, who is the head of the Department of General Medicine at the Sri Satya Sai General Hospital in Prashanthi Nilayam. In part one of this conversation, Dr. Sunil Menon introduced us to the topic of integrative health, that is a holistic approach to healthcare, and touched upon so many fascinating aspects of health which go beyond just the physical and which resonate or echo what Bhagwan tells us about holistic health, the whole, the mind-body-spirit connection. So to take this conversation further, I have a bunch of questions, and it's interesting because when this interview was played on our live show Morning Glory, as he was speaking, we were getting questions from our listeners, and I will try to incorporate your queries in today's discussion. On that note, I welcome Dr. Sunil Menon. Sairam.
Sairam. Nice to be here.
And it's wonderful to have you here once again with us to learn more from you. So, sir, we'll start with this topic of choosing good fats in our diet. Last week when I asked you a personal question, I said, what kind of fats do you consume? You mentioned ghee and you're in favor of cold-pressed coconut oil. And you said olive oil is also good, but it's an expensive option in this part of the world. Now, If somebody has got cardiac issues or gone through some history of health related to the heart, a bypass or something, would the same advice apply to them?
Well, let me begin by saying that conventional medicine or Western medical practice has always told us, and I was taught the same when I was a postgraduate student, that the main problem is cholesterol. All over the world, we were asked to eat a low-fat, high-carbohydrate, complex-carbohydrate diet. And now, research seems to point the other way.
Hmm.
Although cholesterol is one of the agents that is involved in the final problems with atherosclerosis,
mm-hmm.
it is unfortunately not the main thing that's involved in inflammation of the arteries, leading to changes that finally land up with atherosclerosis and a plaque. This is, for the present moment, a very controversial subject. And especially in a talk show, to give all the details would not be possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the research has now come out in the open, and they are discussing the role of cholesterol, because they find that a large percentage of people who do get heart attacks have normal cholesterol.
Hmm.
They also find that lowering the cholesterol levels by different means has not changed how they progress with their condition at all. There are other factors involved, and the main factor they have now focusing on is the use of sugar and refined carbohydrates. They are the main culprits because they cause inflammation in the arteries. They trigger chronic inflammation syndrome, and chronic inflammation is the subject of research today. If people want to know more about the subject, they should try to get some books that have been come out in this area. And one important book that is being well read all around is called The Cholesterol Myth. And we find indigenous people have always been using ghee and coconut oils since thousands of years. Why should they start misbehaving? The problem is the refining and the purity of the source. So if you get pure ghee from a cow who eats grass, it's not going to do any harm to you.
Mm-hmm.
If you use cold-pressed oils in your diet, they're found the body takes care of it. Simply said, God did not create cholesterol for it to go and block your heart. Cholesterol is an important agent in our body. It does a lot of important functions. So the theory that lowering cholesterol is the magic bullet that can cure heart disease is gone out of the window.
Mm-hmm.
But a case of warning, people who had heart attacks or got issues and they have got coronary artery disease, we wouldn't ask them to suddenly start using saturated oil in their diets. We would prefer that they keep control on that
mm-hmm.
and reduce it as far as possible. But as far as the contribution of cholesterol to heart conditions, that theory is now changing. And I recommend people to, you know, go on the web or go to a doctor who can talk more about it. My recommendation is if somebody needs to know, they should go to a doctor who knows a little bit of nutritional medicine and the role of fats in the body. And doctors who are in the States, they are known as functional medicine doctors. And if whoever wants to know about this meets a functional medicine doctor, he will get a direct input of how much of these oils he can use.
Mm. Very interesting. And I remember reading somewhere that even the French cuisine, which is pretty heavy on cheese and butter and widely used, and people eat croissants and, you know, all kinds of confectionaries, even they don't have such a high rate of heart problem as compared to Americans.
Absolutely right. The fact is, when the initial studies were done a long, long time ago, the doctor who introduced this theory had actually tweaked the results. And he left France out because France didn't fit into his theory at all.
Oh.
And it's called the seven countries theory. So he picked seven countries that fitted the theory he had.
Which is that cholesterol is the culprit.
Is the culprit. And uh-huh. and then the rest of the bandwagon picked it up. Unfortunately, that's how science goes somewhere, because he was a very persuasive and a very strongly opinionated doctor.
Hmm.
And people listened to him. And he wrote up this research paper and people said yes. And now they went back to the original study and found that compared to, I think, about 21 countries were involved, and he picked only 7 that fitted his results. So that is why the theory is now really being looked at, and people don't really believe that there is a direct connection between levels of cholesterol. In fact, a new cholesterol test has come. They don't look at just levels of cholesterol. They look at what is known as the particles and the particle size. And they found LDL, which has been, you know, maligned as a very bad particle. It's got two forms, LDL-A and LDL-B. If you got high LDL and it's all LDL-A, you're fine. You can eat as much saturated fat as you can. Unfortunately, if you have high levels of LDL-B, that is where the problem comes. So just saying cholesterol is not enough. We need to do this new test that's been used in the States for quite a long time. It's not come to all the countries yet. But people are aware of the test, usually ask the patient to do it, and then classify you as which category you belong to. If you belong to LDL-B, then they'll ask you to be careful.
Okay, that is more precise to understand. Now, I had a question, because in this age and day, we hear a lot about this word detox. Everybody is doing a detox. And if you read Swami's literature, Swami says the detox has to begin at a very deep level with all the emotion, the ties we carry, the psychological burden, maybe past life from before or childhood. What are your thoughts on this?
To answer that question very simply, the detox we talk about is only for the body. And as far as we know, ancient cultures and most of the Chinese Ayurvedic systems, the naturopathy systems, they always talk about you have to detox your body once in a while. In the past, I think families used to give people castor oil and clear the system. They used to do things like that. Detox is a natural process. The liver is the main organ. And it's got phase 1, phase 2 detox systems. It is actually meant for toxins which are present even in normal food. We presume that normal food is non-toxic, but that's not the case. There are things in there, chemicals in there, the body doesn't need. And when we say detox, means the body throws away the items of the food that is harmful to the body in the long run and not useful to the body. That's what detox is all about. And the liver does it all the time. Unfortunately, of course, in today's world, we are detoxing chemicals, which the human being is facing for the first time. And that is where the problem comes. The liver doesn't know what to do with it. It gets overburdened with things it has not seen before in our biological origin. Mm-hmm. And invariably, they tend to create health issues which need to be addressed one way or the other. The best way is to keep away from these items, but unfortunately we can't. Processing of food has created a large percentage of items that slip through the system.
Preservatives.
Very true. So what does the liver do? Now, detoxing has two processes. It has to throw it out. If these things are soluble in fat, it throws it out through the bile.
Okay.
If it is soluble in water, it throws it out through the kidney.
Okay.
Some things can actually come out in your sweat. So which means if a hot sauna, running and exercising and sweating a lot is one way your body naturally detoxes. And
what if you don't have a gallbladder, if you have removed it?
It is a problem, yes, true. We have to replace the bile with ox bile or some kind of substitutions. We have to be very, very careful. We have to take enzyme supplements that will help in the liver. It's an important question because people without a gallbladder, detoxifying is an issue. They have to be very, very careful that they don't eat oily food. Mm-hmm. They eat food that they can digest, and they keep away from things which are not organic. The liver generally doesn't function, you know, that efficiently, which is why extra supplementation is recommended, which is what we do. So as I was saying, that detoxing is a natural process, and the modern lifestyle has created issues. And so we periodically should have a process of detoxing. And the simplest way is to go on a juice fast. I don't recommend dramatic fasting. It's not a very healthy option. A lot of people can't do it. But if you switch to a fruit juice or a vegetable juice or some kind of a liquid fast, which will help the body system to really re-gear itself, and the liver to get a little break from, you know, how busy it is.
I see.
And that's the simplest form you can do at home. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to a dramatic form of detoxing, then, you know, they do it in a very dramatic way by giving you a lot of detoxing supplements. You have to get then admitted to a place and, you know, they detox you.
Yeah.
Along with cleansing, which way they do colonic cleansing and then they call it lymphatic cleansing, where they do massage, which is part of the Ayurvedic process.
Yes.
The choice is what your body can stand, because a lot of people can't detox very well. So when they start detoxing, all these chemicals that are hiding in their system will come out and they feel worse for some time. So detoxing sometimes is to be done under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest problem is heavy metals, which are there in our system, they hide in our fat cells. And that's the only thing the body can do. It can't throw it out, it can't detox. So they hide it in our fat cells. And if you try to detox, these heavy metals can come back into the blood and cause issues. So doctors recommend that you remove the heavy metals first by a process of chelation. And that's again, you know, in a hospital environment by special units who have experience in it. You have to measure the levels of heavy metals in your body, and there are various tests that can do that. Unfortunately, in India, we don't really do much of this. But in the States, especially the functional medicine group of doctors, they tend to measure the toxins in your system.
I think in India, we've sort of caught up between our own culture and its wisdom and our desire to ape the Western culture without quite having the know-how, because in ancient times, you might have noticed a lot of Indians, Hindus especially, fast during the two Navratris of October and April, and it's supposed to be, actually, in Vedic age, that was how people would detoxify during the change of weather, because one was during spring leading to summer, the other is at fall leading to winter. So they would fast for the 9 days to prepare their body for the next season. But now it's become associated with the puja and everything. Over time, many things are lost in translation. But we did have our own detoxing systems, and we would do a lot of prayers to clear our mind and our emotions. But that's sort of lost in rituals now, unfortunately. Now, last week you talked to us about the koshas, or the sheets, the different layers that make a person, and you touched upon the physical and the mental, pranamaya and manomaya kosha. Could you go beyond that and enlighten us, doctor, please?
The koshas are so important because generally when we look at the body, we tend to focus on the physical body. And Swami has taught a lot about food has got a subtle element. And it's the subtle element of the food that goes into the manomaya kosha. So what you eat becomes a part of your mind.
Okay.
And these are, in quantum physics terms, these are all vibrations. And food, every molecule, every atom has got its own harmonics and vibrations. And which is why, although you may say animal food, actually it's got animal vibrations.
Mm.
Now science has not measured it, and unfortunately we don't accept this as scientific truth, but Swami has clearly said that the whole universe is just made of vibrations in different forms, and these vibrations can be transferred. And we talk about positive vibrations, negative vibrations. Food itself is a chemical system, and as the Annamaya kosha absorbs the physical bit of it, we presume that the nothing else happens. But then what happens is the subtle vibrations get through. You have to be very careful about not even the food itself, but who cooked it. Because the Vedic theory says that even the person who cooked the food is important.
Yeah, the thoughts of that person are transferred.
That's right. So you cook it with love, you cook it with affection, you cook it not in haste. And then you eat food in a divine fashion. So instead of watching television and talking and arguing and losing your energy, you actually conserve your energy. And the reason for that, you do it in a meditative fashion, because it is, you are transferring vibrations. And that should be done in that fashion, so that the body then will pick and do its job. You know, we also do the food prayer, which is important. Again, you know, we clear any negative influences. And all this affects the mind, and so the basic thing starts with the eating, the format of eating, and selection of the food, which can affect the mind. That is step number one.
Mm-hmm.
That will create positive vibrations in the mind itself. And then, of course, you have to train the mind. And invariably, you know, that's a process where you can't control it. You can't order it. The mind is always like a horse. And you have to rein in. You have to rein in the mind all the time. And it comes only with practice. It's not part of the medical philosophy to tell a patient to do that. But we found that patients with a very positive attitude, with faith in the doctor and faith in the treatment, tend to, you know, improve and get cured and give good results. Mm-hmm. And it's not rocket science to understand that the mind is playing a part. Mm-hmm. And we all understand it, but in today's hectic world, you know, we all become an assembly line practice. Mm-hmm. We hardly give much time to the patient. And the patient also wants instant results. So that's the connection between that. The pranamaya kosha is something which is ignored entirely because that's the energy body. And the energy body, or the prana, as we call it, it's got energy flow in our system. And there are ways in which the energy can get blocked and ways in which the energy is transferred. And it should flow. The first rule of law is this energy should flow. It should also concentrate in areas where you are at. So basically, if you are doing a job which is very animal-based, or you're just digesting food, most of the energy goes there. As your thoughts, processes, and your way of lifestyle changes, your energy starts or should be getting focused at a higher level. And people have sort of understood this, like the chakras and the Kundalini Shakti, how it is, you know, it raises itself and all that, which again is not scientific proof, but that is what the yogis have been doing. The fact is that if you are functioning at the optimal energy level for whatever job you're doing, you'll find you're functioning better and your results are better. It is only when we have a very distracted format of addressing a problem, we are thinking one thing and saying another thing and doing another thing, that shows your energy flow is not very controlled.
And you don't have Trikarna Shuddhi.
Exactly. And the yogis talk about how this can be sorted. There are various methodologies to address. But that needs a guru to do that. I mean, each person has their own methodology of rectifying their energy processes. Depending on where you are, they will recommend a particular process. It's not a standard therapy for 50 people, sit down and, you know, reset your energy levels. The guru actually selects. Most of us are at a very baseline level. And you'll find that some baseline practices will help us out in some way to function in the world better. If you want to go into the spiritual realm, then that's an entirely different process where it has to be individually prescribed.
I see. Very deep. Wow. Okay. Now, a not-so-deep question. Last week, you spoke about some animals that make their own vitamin C, and it was noticed in research that when they were ill, the production of vitamin C went up by 1,000% to fight. Now, as an immunity booster, first of all, how much vitamin C should one aim for? What are good sources in your opinion? And we hear that cancer also can respond, early stages of cancer can respond to enhanced immunity. What are your thoughts on that, doctor?
Again, the question, as far as conventional medicine is concerned, they don't agree with the use of vitamin C. They also presume that you're getting enough vitamin C. The question we have to ask is, does your body need more? And they have found that that is true. Even if you are eating the required amount of fruits and vegetables and raw food and fresh food, your body may be needing more. This is again very individual, and we find that some people need much more than the others because their immune system is under stress and they got issues in the body that is using up vitamin C a lot. It needs a prescriber to decide from your symptoms and your history and your background of your diet and your illness, whether vitamin C is required or not. Non-conventional medicine has done a lot of work on this. And in fact, most of the doctors who practice this form of medicine, they tend to be out of mainstream medicine. They got results which are amazing, where they use extremely high doses of vitamin C. They can't claim that the condition is cured, but the quality of life changes. So patients who have been given up hope and who have said that, you know, the cancer is spread all over the body, you've got 6 months to live, have continued to live for 5 years with a good quality of life. people who had infections that were not responding when vitamin C was added to the regimen. They found dramatically, you know, the condition can improve. The dosage, you know, can't be really mentioned as a general format. Mm-hmm. But if you get about 200 to 400 milligrams of vitamin C, so you need a nutritionist to find out what you're eating and whether you're eating it fresh. If you cook it and if you preserve it and if you eat it after 3 days, then the vitamin C is gone. It oxidizes very quickly. But if you get fresh wheat, you know, a mango from the tree, you know, the chances of getting vitamin C, or a papaya from the plant itself. Papaya has got a lot of vitamin C. Amla has got a lot of vitamin C.
Amla is the Indian gooseberry.
Indian gooseberry.
Yeah.
It depends on how fresh it is. Mm-hmm. If you're not sure that you need vitamin C, you get repeated colds and repeated infections and you find that, okay, you've got skin issues that keep coming and going. If your doctor feels that maybe your immune system needs a little boost, you can try taking some vitamin C.
Supplement.
Mm-hmm. The problem is synthetic vitamin C that's available over the counter,
yeah.
They're not very good. And of course, they're not bad, but they're not good enough to really supplement your needs. So either it's fresh food or it is a supplement which is not in a synthetic form.
How about something like lemon juice?
You have to sort of drink a lot of it to okay. get the required amount. Okay. So that is the problem. So if you eat about 6 or 7 oranges a day or 7 or 8 apples a day, you know,
wow, that's a lot.
That's a lot. So that's the reason a supplement is a shortcut to that, provided you get a standard one from a good company.
Mm-hmm.
It should certainly go a long way.
Now, there's this talk about the fight between alkaline and acid. We hear a lot, because cancer has become so rampant around us, that if our bodies are more alkaline, then the chances of cancer cells growing are less.
It's again, like I said, not in conventional medicine. We don't really believe that theory at all. And nor we change the diet for a cancer patient. But like I said, people who have been working on this area, they have found that foods can be classified as acid, alkaline, or those that fall in the middle. In a general way, all the meats are acidic. And the grains also belong to the same group. It's only the vegetables and the fruits are alkaline.
Which are alkaline.
So one of the ways of treating cancer patients is with raw food diet. And you know, they eat sprouts and raw food diet, and they keep off dairy products and grains and meat, which is a tough call because it's impossible, you know, not to include one of these items. But they can eat rare forms of, you know, quinoa or amaranth or seeds as a substitute. To eat that way is not easy. It's not easily available. And then to stick to it is extremely difficult. But what these researchers have found, that the human beings can live pretty okay with that kind of diet. And they are pretty surprised. And are quite surprised how that is happening.
So this is the diet of seeds and these rare grains. And fruits and vegetables.
And fruits and vegetables, yeah.
That's what rishis ate, right? They ate
very
nuts,
true.
Fruits.
And such, and well, seeds and nuts.
Seeds and nuts.
Yeah.
Now, Swami says, you know, some people are rogis, bhogis and yogis. And the yogis ate what you're prescribing or suggesting for some patients who have cancer. And Swami also says when you sit down to a meal, you finish a meal, you should get up feeling as light as when you sat. So that's real serious calorie restriction, right?
You see, the thing is, few people realize normal people are constantly producing cancer cells.
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize it. They are cells that's, you know, gone the wrong way. So we presume cancer is some huge thing that just jumped on you. It isn't the case. All of us are producing cancer cells and they're getting mopped up.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as your system works efficiently to mop them up, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
So cancer is not a bogeyman that comes and catches you.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. So it's a reality of natural life.
Mm-hmm.
If the environment, your diet, your lifestyle helps the cancer, then it picks up speed and goes to some part of your body and it grows. The problem is cancer survives on glucose and sugar, and our diet is basically supplying a lot of sugar to the cancer cells. We have to starve them. One of the ways of killing them off is to starve them.
Starve them of sugar.
Of sugar. And the way to do that is to go on a high complex raw food diet, which actually starves them of direct sugars. So that's how the theory came up, and you know, they applied this to patients, and they found some of the cancers, you know, go into remission.
Mm-hmm. how does one determine how many calories one should consume to maintain an optimal kind of health? Obviously, it'll depend on your height and weight. But Swami is suggesting very light eating habits, right? And most of us need that mental satisfaction of having had a good, satisfying meal.
I think that's a very good question you asked, because the controversy in nutritional medicine is all about this. Calorie in and calorie out. Mm. That theory is unfortunately gone.
Okay.
It depends on how you burn calories. So if your body is a fast burner and burns calories very well, you're lucky. You got a fast metabolism and you can eat what you like. If your body has a slow metabolism, then you have to be extremely careful, because a little bit of cheating and you put on weight. Well, how do we switch you and make you a fast metabolizer?
Yes, please tell us.
is the question everybody asks me quite a lot. And that's where the whole new theory about fat comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you want to feel full and satisfied, you have to eat fat. And fat, unfortunately, is not the problem. It is sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So what people do is they drastically diet and they feel terribly hungry. And then they actually eat a carb-based food or a sugar-based food, which even a small amount can switch the other way. Fat, the body really can't use much. And in order to burn fat, it needs energy. And, you know, fat is something that helps you go thin. So there's a new book that's come up, and I was looking through it recently. It's called Eat Fat and Get Thin.
Hmm.
And that theory has now come up, and they got a lot of scientific evidence. And where the evidence came from is, when they tried to fatten pigs with oil, they thought if you give them extra oil, they'll all fatten up and they can be sold, because the
and
weight increased.
Oil, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately for them, after 3 months, the pigs lost weight. So they were very surprised that what is fat doing? So fat actually has got a system in the body where it switches the body to the other side.
Hmm.
And Atkins' diet, which became very famous,
yes,
it's not a good diet to follow, but all he did was tell patients to eat meat and fat.
Fat, yeah.
And what happened? They felt the weight disappeared.
Because of the ketosis, but it was temporary and it affected people's kidneys.
True. The trouble is now they changed that. The new Atkins diet is now a little more sensible.
Now they're more glycemic in there.
Yeah. So invariably what we must realize is we must be sensible about this. And you have to get supervised before you do all this. But what I mean is, today's world, the problem is carbohydrates and refined carbohydrates and sugar. That is sneaking into our food all the time. And it's not the poor fat. You can eat as much ghee as you want, and nothing will happen to you, provided you are a fast metabolizer and, you know, you're compensating it with the other nutrients. So eating fat becomes fat theory is gone.
Hmm. Okay, tell us a little bit more about how to convert a slow metabolism into a fast one.
It's not very easy, because a lot of genetics are involved. So you're born with, you know, a type of metabolism. And,
so you're fighting nature.
Which is fighting nature. And in fact, now what they do is they don't have a standard diet prescribed for everybody. They say that you come into our office, we see what you do with food. So they got a lot of diet possibilities. And they find, to their surprise, when they mix and match certain types of foods, they reach a formula for you and say that as long as you are eating these kinds of foods and as long as your hormones are working, you know, because your thyroid hormone and your cortisol, your stress factors, how you think, how you act, are you a type A personality or not, all these factors act with each other. So today the science of dieting is not that straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go in and find out, how does my body work?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a lot of patients know that when they do certain things, they put on weight very quickly. And they cheat on it, and they don't keep to a diet because it's boring, because they can't live in the world by being peculiar and eating certain peculiar things. But strictly speaking, the main problem is sugar and processed food. If you take that out,
everything comes back to that. Yeah. I hear from what you're saying, whatever reduces to a simple sugar is the culprit.
Because all stories tell us that when people were traveling around the world and they lived with the indigenous cultures,
right,
they lost weight.
Mm-hmm.
They became scrawny, thin, and the muscle area built up, the muscle strength built up, and the fat melted away.
Mm.
Just because they shifted to a very basic, natural, indigenous diet the tribals were eating, where the food most probably was not overcooked, had all the vitamins and nutrients, and was well balanced, and didn't have all the extra cooking processes which destroyed the nutrients in them.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, you spoke about these traditional diets, so it reminded me, I have a question here from a listener of our show, Rekha Loknath, who wanted to know your thoughts on the millet diet to keep diabetes under control.
Well, if she's talking about finger millet, yes, and that is the ragi,
yes,
we have found that if you eat it in the traditional way, the trouble with food is if it is processed.
Okay.
The ragi is classified depending on the methodology used to measure it. Some people say the glycemic index is very low. Some people say the glycemic index is very high. It depends on particle size again. So if you eat ragi in its traditional fashion,
which is what, like a mudda, like a steaming?
Yeah, and it's not milled by, you know, a machine milling process, okay, where it's made into ragi flour.
Okay.
The main good effect of ragi is the high fiber content.
Okay.
And it is the fiber that's really helpful here. So we know that high complex carbohydrate fiber-filled foods are safe. So it's not just the millet. You have to see what is the source, how has it been manufactured and processed. And if it is traditionally made, then that is a good substitute as compared to wheat and rice.
Now, there's so many millets out there, finger millet, foxtail millet. Yeah. What's the mystery behind?
Well, they all come from different sources and different varieties.
And quinoa also seems to be
actually, it's a seed. So
it's a seed. Yeah. Okay.
So the thing is, you don't have to be very exotic because millet is a very good substitute.
And bajra is not different from millet.
Yeah, it's also a type of, I think it's called sorghum or something of the sort, isn't it? These things, you know, traditionally, you know, there's a new science come up. If you genetically belong to a particular class of people who through centuries have eaten a particular diet, then your genes actually are built to do that. So when you're switching diet, you must check whether it agrees with you. For example, in France and Scandinavia, they can drink milk. They don't have lactose intolerance at all. It's unknown because they have traditionally been drinking milk. Unlike the problems with milk all over the world, 70% of people can't tolerate milk. They're intolerant to it. The other problem is milk comes in two forms, A1 and A2. So all these things matter, where we come from, what our forefathers have been eating, because we are the genetic inheritance of our forefathers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, about exercise, what's the skinny on that? How much of exercise should one incorporate in our lifestyle? Is it necessary? Is just an active lifestyle good enough?
Yeah, I can try to simplify it as much as possible, because, again, that's a subject which is sold all over the world. And exercise has become a fashion, and people are making a lot of money. You know,
celebrities,
exactly, yeah. And they're building up six packs and whatever they call it. The fact is, yes, there are two forms of exercise. One is aerobic, and the other is resistance exercises. And aerobic exercises use up oxygen, and the simplest thing is to go walking. And 30 minutes is what recommended, at least thrice a week, if it's possible for you. We would start with the program of, walking briskly the first 5 minutes the other way around. You walk pretty slowly in the first 5 to 10 minutes, and then you make it very brisk in the middle part of it. And then in the last bit of it, you slow down again. You need not do walking. You can do yoga. You can do anything that actually affects your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So we call it aerobic because, you know, you tend to breathe faster. There is another point is your heart rate should be built up to a certain level to get the effect of the exercise. So if it doesn't go around, there's a calculation for it, and people can calculate what your heart rate should be. The other bit is the resistance exercises, which again can use machines, which is mainly for the muscles, which is also good to keep it on tone and to build their muscle strength, and old people should try some of it. You can use your own body weight against resistance for that at home. Again, yoga is very good. It's an alternative which you can do. How many minutes of yoga do you need? Well, it depends on your experience with doing exercises and yoga. You build on what you're doing. They'll give you more and more difficult asanas. If it is jogging, usually we recommend around 4 kilometers a day is enough. If you can do, you don't do 4 kilometers on the first day. You start with one and then keep building it up. Which should make you do it within 30 to 40 minutes. The idea is people tend to adjust the exercise. How do we know it has worked? Well, your body weight will come down and you'll feel fitter and you'll feel more energetic. And when you reach a threshold of feeling good, you stop. Don't try to overdo it because that is as bad.
Mm-hmm. too much of anything. You spoke about six packs, so I wanted to know, a listener had a question, is it ever possible to achieve one of those on a vegetarian diet? Because there's so much emphasis on protein these days.
Well, that is the question frequently asked by vegetarians. Now, what we don't understand or we don't know is that vegetables contain protein too. So we feel protein has to be in a living animal or from meat or meat product. A protein is there in lentils and legumes. The problem with the protein intake is you need a variety of proteins to get the essential amino acids. So if you are eating a diet which doesn't have this variety, we are in trouble. Poverty is the big issue in India. So most of the poor people, just to fill their bellies, they have substituted a balanced diet with carbohydrate. And that is the issue here. A vegetarian should be balancing the diet a little carefully. So if you're a pure vegetarian, you must see, these are the kind of lentils I'm going to go through in a week's time. Mm-hmm. And rotate them and mix the lentils and mix the legumes. So as you mix, the protein quality improves. A lot of people...
But which are lentils and which are legumes?
Well, pardon? The dals are the lentils and the beans are the legumes.
Beans are the legumes, like rajma and chana.
Yeah, and if you mix them, the quality of the protein doubles.
Oh, that's very good to know.
And,
big tip, doctor.
And that's the way to eat. So basically, if you're cooking,
you can mix the two.
Yeah. Along with the vegetables. So we tend to stick to, a standard way of, people buy the same dal, the same bean.
And they cook it the same boring way.
So
it's
the idea is
to get creative.
The more creative you are, the more you mix, the quality improves. So you're balanced.
Last week on the show, you spoke about Dr. Dean Ornish's study and his startling findings. Could you throw some light on that, sir?
Yes, Dean Ornish is a very, very interesting person because he was the first person who had the courage to challenge the usual thinking in conventional medicine that a holistic approach will not help. And he picked a number of extremely serious cardiac cases. And he changed their diet completely. And in fact, he put them on a very organic vegetarian diet. And he took off all the processed food and the sugars. And then he put them on a holistic program, which included meditation and yoga. And the results were quite startling. And this was, looked at by other doctors and other institutions picked it up. And now Dean Ornish himself has got his own institute who runs the program. And invariably, the improvement was dramatic. They didn't expect that these cases who were having a poor quality life, conventional medicine wasn't helping them much. And Dean Ornish then started off linking a holistic approach to health, saying that it's just not the diet change. And in his case, quite a large percentage of the improvement was the diet change. But he also introduced the holistic approach of yoga and meditation, something called group therapy, because isolation and loneliness and ignoring the human contact has got very bad health effects. And invariably, stress is the underlying factor. So now we understand that chronic long-term stress can produce cancer, it can produce heart attacks, it can produce, name any disease, and chronic long-term stress is the background of all the issues. We should address that in one form or the other. And Dean Ornish's approach, which seems to address all the factors, including, as now we know, the mind, body, spirit. And in a way, he is the pioneer who introduced that approach. Now that has been worked on by other doctors, and it has been taken further on, saying that we need to not only correct the mind, body, spirit, but our whole lifestyle of living in this artificial environment, artificial light, television whole day long, mobile phones in your pocket. So we are being hit by electromagnetic radiation. We have been hit by preservatives in the food. We have been hit by toxins in the atmosphere. So it's a tough situation for modern man because we are being hit on all sides. And the human body is suffering because of it.
I see. So my final question then becomes, Dr. Menon, how do you practice integrative medicine in the Sri Satyasai General Hospital?
We haven't started practicing it in the full form because we're going to have a first seminar on it this Sunday.
Oh, wonderful.
We are going to introduce...
On October the 24th.
23rd, I think, is it?
Okay.
Yes, that's the first seminar. We're going to introduce our doctors to the idea. We're having Dr. Acharya, who is the director of Whitefield Hospital, who's a visiting dermatologist. And he's very much into holistic approach and integrated approach in medicine. And he's going to talk, give a keynote address. And he's got a lot of success curing psoriasis and dermatitis and chronic eczemas by having a holistic approach.
That's a great tip, because a listener did send a question about that. So that is Dr. Acharya from our Whitefield Hospital.
That's right, yes. And he's going to introduce what his findings are and what the success rate is, which will be interesting to know. So we are building on some of this philosophy. We already got the yoga section started off, and we got Dr. Hema, who's joined us recently, who does the yoga.
So she does yoga with the patients?
With the patients. So we actually refer patients to her with different issues. And what she has done is modified the yoga to make it 21st century. That is very simple. You can sit on a chair and do it. And you can do it for just about 10 minutes a day. And she's blessed by Swami for it. So Swami told her to come back to Parthi and do this. So when she retired, she remembered the promise and she's come back to help us. And she actually goes all over the world teaching this what I call shotgun yoga, because it's very simple, it's very quick, and it doesn't need you to take a lesson from a guru for 10 years. It just needs about half an hour to learn it from her. And we are trying to find out what the results are. Her results in her personal experience is very good. But we are going to make it evidence-based. And we are going to see and follow these patients for at least a year. And maybe next year we'll have some more information on the success of it.
Wonderful. And we will look forward to sharing it with our listeners on Radio Sai.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Sai Ram.
Sai Ram.
Single story of His infinite glory, captured through divine discourses, music, bhajans, and through Vedas, talk shows, interviews, panel discussion, and study circles. All brought to you live from the epicenter of our times, Prashanti Nilayam, India. Radio Sai Thursday Live.